Thank you for joining the Collaborative Ependymoma Research Network's podcast for spring of 2014 entitled Ask CERN a Question. My name is Charles Haynes and I'll be the moderator today. This podcast consists of a series of questions submitted to the CERN Foundation via social media. In the interest of time and brevity, some of the questions have been edited or combined with others. Also, please note that due to the number of questions submitted, we're unable to answer all of the questions in the time we have today, but we do plan to conduct additional podcasts in the future, so please be sure to check our website, our Facebook page, and follow us on Twitter to be apprised of upcoming events. As many of the listeners know, the CERN Foundation's research efforts are organized around five distinct yet interrelated projects. These core research projects are part of a coordinated effort to bring novel treatments from the lab to the clinic as quickly as possible. I'm joined on this podcast by the leaders of each of the five projects as follows. For Project 1, Clinical Trials, I'm joined by Dr. Mark Gilbert and Dr. Amar Gajar. For Project 2, Tumor Profiling and Pathology, I'm joined by Dr. Ken Aldape. For Projects 3 and 4, Developmental Therapeutics and Tumor Modeling, respectively, I'm joined by Dr. Richard Gilbertson. And for Project 5, Patient Outcomes, I'm joined by Dr. Terry Armstrong. Taking the projects in order and starting with Project 1, Dr. Gilbert, I'll ask you some general questions of a clinical nature. A number of our respondents asked if you could describe the current standard of care for adults with ependymoma.
So it's a great question, and the approach to any patient really depends on the circumstance, what type of ependymoma they have, the location of that ependymoma, the symptoms that are associated with the ependymoma. And starting from the beginning, the first is an evaluation of the extent of the disease. So we start with imaging studies. MRI is the most common imaging that we use for those patients who, for some reason, cannot undergo MRI testing, either because of a pacemaker or other implanted metal, then we have to use a CT scan technology. But we do start with an MRI, and we try to get a sense of the full extent of the disease. Although uncommon, it is possible for ependymoma to spread from one area of the nervous system to another. So, for example, a brain ependymoma can have tumor cells released into the spinal fluid, and sometimes we do find deposits of tumor along the spine. So it's very important that we do this type of process before we embark on treatment. So then, if it is a localized process, we contemplate surgery. And there have been many studies that have shown that an extensive surgical procedure is extremely beneficial. So much so that there are times when the surgeon does an initial operation and finds postoperatively that there has been some tumor left behind, they often plan a second operation to remove that tumor. That's how important the surgical resection can be. Following the surgical resection, we have the tumor tissue undergo extensive evaluation by our colleagues in pathology. Then, depending upon the type of ependymoma, the tumor grade, we make decisions about subsequent treatment. For example, for the low-grade or the grade 1 ependymoma, which we often call myxopapillary ependymoma, if the neurosurgeon is successful in removing the entire tumor, we often just observe. For the higher grade tumor, for the grade 3 ependymoma, also known as anaplastic ependymoma, we always follow the surgical procedure with radiation. For the middle grade or the grade 2 ependymoma, it varies. It depends upon the location of the tumor. It depends upon the extent of resection, whether we embark on observation and surveillance or whether we proceed to radiation treatment.
So with surgery such an important part of ependymoma treatment, what are the possible outcomes that a patient should expect?
So I think that the outcomes from surgery are really dependent upon the location of the tumor, the area of the nervous system. For example, there are tumors that occur in the front part of the frontal lobe, and that is a safe area to do an extensive resection. And then there are other tumors, for example, that are right near the motor area of the brain or speech area of the brain, and you have to be much more careful because you can have some permanent deficits if, in fact, those areas are damaged during the surgery. The other important consideration, of course, is the skill and the experience of the surgeon doing the procedure. And we often recommend that these types of surgeries are done by neurosurgeons who have specific expertise in these types of neurosurgical surgical procedures, that they use the most advanced navigation technology in order to be able to do the safest and most complete operation.
Indeed, that's very important. And what are the things that a surgeon is looking for in order to say that it's time to remove a tumor? Is it the size of the tumor? Is it symptoms? Or perhaps is it a combination of the two? So I guess what I'm asking is, what factors tip the scales in favor of surgery as opposed to waiting?
So this question about the timing for surgery is really in a situation where you have an abnormality on an imaging study, either the brain or the spinal cord, and you're making a decision whether or not a surgical procedure to make a diagnosis is appropriate. If we have a small area of abnormality and its characteristics by this imaging technology does not look particularly concerning, then observation is often pursued, but very close observation to make sure that this is not a rapidly growing tumor. If it has characteristics that make it very suggestive that it is a cancer, then there should be no delay in going forward with a procedure, either to make a diagnosis if it is not surgically removable, or a complete resection if that is in fact feasible.
And one final question, Dr. Gilbert. What happens when a spinal cord tumor lessens or cuts off the free flow of spinal cord fluid?
So when a spinal cord tumor is so large that it prevents the flow of spinal fluid, then there may be issues with increase in pressure. More importantly, when this phenomenon occurs in the brain and the flow of spinal fluid is blocked, then you get a situation called hydrocephalus. And that hydrocephalus means that the pools, the reservoirs of spinal fluid in the middle of the brain called the ventricles, balloon. And it causes a tremendous neurologic symptoms, headaches, can cause loss of consciousness, and in fact, if untreated, can cause coma. So it's very important that spinal fluid flow is maintained. And when we see a situation where there is blockage, particularly in the brain, it does often require some type of procedure like placing a shunt to divert the extra fluid.
Thank you, Dr. Gilbert.
Thank you.
So turning now to some pediatric clinical questions, I'm joined by Dr. Amar Gajar. Dr. Gajar, generally speaking, is the standard of care different for children versus adults?
The principles of treating ependymoma are the same between adult and children. Primarily, surgical resection of the tumor, try to get as much of the tumor out, followed by radiation therapy. The only exception comes in very young children, where we would not like to expose the children to radiation therapy, where often we would use chemotherapy to treat the tumors till the child gets a little older.
And what is the difference between photon versus proton radiation?
A very good question. So photon radiation is a traditional radiation that we all used to and we've been getting for the last 20, 30 years. Proton radiation is a new radiation technique which is gradually getting more of access to patients across the United States and the world. So with photon radiation, the particle, the radiation enters the brain, targets the region where we want to radiate with the highest dose, and there's an exit dose, so there's a larger volume of brain which gets radiated. With proton radiation therapy, you can pretty much target the area that you want to radiate. There's no exit dose for the radiation therapy. Hence, there's much less cumulative overall radiation of the brain. And particularly in children, where we want to preserve normal tissue from getting radiated, it has theoretical advantages.
And is it the case that chemotherapy is less effective for ependymoma than other types of brain tumors? And if that's true, why would this be?
I think the way to answer that question is that we are just now on the cusp of understanding ependymoma in a way that we've never understood it before. We know there are different subtypes of ependymoma based on the molecular features of the tumor, and we are now discovering new drugs which are specific to each of the subtypes of ependymoma. So we treated ependymoma just like ice cream, but now there's chocolate and vanilla, and now we're targeting therapies which would be specific to the chocolate ice cream or the vanilla ice cream. And I think that is going to give us a latitude to find more effective therapies for ependymoma patients with chemotherapy in addition to surgery and radiation.
Okay. And radiation treatments were prescribed or are often prescribed for less than total resections. However, there are more factors involved. Can you describe those other factors?
So the principle of curing ependymoma is trying to get as much tumor out as possible. And with advanced surgery and with imaging techniques like intraoperative MRI, surgeons are now doing amazing jobs of getting tumors out from very difficult locations. However, there are still some tumors which are not accessible to surgeons without causing extensive and permanent damage to the children. In those rare circumstances, we are left with no option but to treat with radiation therapy after surgical resection of the tumor. And I think that's the most critical feature in treating patients with ependymoma, is trying to get a gross total resection.
Finally, Dr. Gajjar, I'd like you to speak on an issue that many have asked leading up to this webinar. In the event that a loved one has passed away, is it possible to donate the tumor directly to CERN? And if not CERN, where should tissue donations be made?
So this is a very difficult time for families, and we understand that. We would, at the current time, CERN is not set up to directly receive tissue from autopsies. However, there are several leading institutions in the country who have got mechanisms set up to accept autopsy tissue, which they in turn could donate to CERN. And what I would recommend is, if the family were so inclined, please discuss with your treating physician, and there'll be plenty of resources your physician will be aware of to guide you in the right direction so that we can get this precious tissue.
Thank you, Dr. Gajjar.
Thank you.
So turning now to Project 2, Tumor Profiling and Pathology, Dr. Ken Aldape, significant debate remains over the World Health Organization's current system of grading ependymomas. Why is tumor classification so important, and what progress has the CERN Foundation made in better understanding the molecular makeup of these types of tumors?
Well, the goal of classification is to match the treatment given an individual patient with the specific disease that that patient has. So as a pathologist, our goal is to classify tumors as appropriately and as precisely as possible. We usually use a microscope to classify tumors on the basis of how they look under the microscope, but on some levels, talking about ependymoma, the specific microscopic features of ependymoma don't always reflect the reality of the disease. And so for that reason, while the microscope is very useful, it doesn't provide everything we need. And the use of molecular diagnostics, as is going on in CERN, would provide us a better means of classifying these tumors to help personalize therapy for patients with this disease.
Can you describe the CERN Foundation's laboratory study and how that resource is contributing to our understanding of ependymoma?
Yes. Ependymoma is driven by key mutations that drive the individual tumor. Tumors that look similar under the microscope might be driven by different mutations of distinct genes and therefore might benefit from different kinds of therapy. The CERN lab study has a goal to molecularly classify these tumors individually so that we can find these key genes that are driving the tumor and better match the patient's tumor with a specific disease that targets that particular cancer mutation.
Can you tell us if a grade 2 ependymoma is considered cancer?
That's a very good question. The term cancer is used generally to categorize a certain kind of tumor or certain kind of disease. While useful as a general term, the term cancer doesn't always apply equally to individual tumor types. The truth is that ependymoma, including grade 2 ependymoma, is a tumor which in some cases has the potential to regrow and to progress despite initial surgery. And it's for that reason that it's necessary to treat these tumors, sometimes with radiation, sometimes with chemotherapy after surgery, to reduce the chance of recurrence and hopefully lead to a cure. And at CERN, we hope to optimize these specific therapies with the goal of curing all patients, as I say, to personalize therapy and match the treatment with the molecular characteristics of the specific tumor.
Thank you, Dr. Aldape. We're turning now to CERN Project 3 and 4, Developmental Therapeutics and Tumor Modeling, and I'm joined by Dr. Richard Gilbertson. Dr. Gilbertson, you recently published a landmark paper on gene sequencing in which you and your colleagues identify the most common genetic alteration ever reported for ependymoma. In layman's terms, can you describe what this means?
Sure. Thanks, Charles. So cancers, we know, are driven by what we call genetic alterations. What that means is the genes that perform normal functions in cells can be altered. They can become abnormal, and that drives the cancer forward. And that can happen through lots of mechanisms, but what we discovered was a mechanism known as translocation happening in ependymoma. That's when two genes that would normally function independently get broken and knitted back together to make a new gene. So this is a gene that doesn't normally happen in nature. It's a bit like taking a train, splitting it apart, and then putting two carriages together that would never normally go together. And that's exactly what happens in ependymoma. So what happens is a normal gene that would be under normal control suddenly becomes expressed at abnormally high levels, and it acquires abnormal functions. And that's what drives ependymoma forward. And what was remarkable was that, you know, normally you'll see genetic alterations in perhaps 10% of a cancer type. So in this form of ependymoma, the type that we find in the front of the brain, over 70% of those kinds of cancer have the same alteration.
Wow. And how are these new findings likely to impact the future of research and treatment?
So there's three ways which it are likely to happen. First of all is on the basic biology side. We now have a major alteration, a major source that drives this cancer. So we have a series of programs now looking at how it works. How does this abnormal gene actually make the cancer happen? The second aspect is more towards the clinical side. So if this is an abnormal gene, can we target it? Can we make drugs that will stop this gene from having its abnormal function? So we have a big program that's looking at ways of inhibiting the activity of that agent. And then more immediately, obviously, because now we have a marker for this disease, which will split patients into different groups, we're starting to understand whether if you have this marker, you do worse than other patients, or in fact, you do better. It's just a way of categorizing the disease.
You're also leading CERN's efforts to screen drugs that might be effective new therapies in the fight against ependymoma. As part of this process, I know that you're looking at some drugs that are already approved by the FDA. Is there an advantage to repurposing these types of drugs?
Yeah, there is. So for a disease like ependymoma that's relatively rare, as you know, we have to test drugs in the context of clinical trials. And that takes a long time, and it takes a fair number of patients. So if we were to actually sort of line up all the drugs that was available for cancer at the moment and to do clinical trials in those for patients with ependymoma, it would take decades and decades. So one of the things we can do is to take the sort of 1,000 drugs that are available for cancer at the moment and screen those through our models and say, which of these should we prioritize for clinical trials so we can focus immediately on those drugs? Now, the advantage of an FDA-approved drug is you can take it straight to the clinic. It's not like a new chemical that you would have to modify and spend years investing research to make it into a drug. So potentially in the space that's already out there for FDA-approved drugs, we can prioritize them and get them quickly to patients.
Right. So I can see the advantage to using drugs that are already approved by the FDA. But is the CERN Foundation also looking at entirely new chemicals and compounds that could be developed into new treatments for ependymoma?
We are. So at St. Jude, we have a program where we've screened over 1.2 million chemicals. That covers all the space you could imagine. Drugs that are existing, but also completely new chemicals that are extracts of plants, extracts of sea creatures, everything you could imagine. Every single chemical on the planet really is covered in that sort of library. And so what we're able to do is to screen the models that we've made of ependymoma against those and identify completely new leads. These are completely new chemicals that aren't currently drugs, but that are very active against the disease. And then we bring those into a pipeline of understanding how that chemistry is working and then understanding how we can shape those ultimately into drugs for patients.
And lastly, there's recently been some interesting research coming out of SickKids in Toronto. How would you anticipate that the CERN Foundation can collaborate and support the efforts of investigators at SickKids?
Yeah, so we already are. So SickKids is actually part of the CERN collaboration already, and Michael Taylor, who led that research, is a really good colleague of ours. And so it's a great example of the synergy with CERN. So we talked at the beginning about the gene alteration that we discovered. What Michael's been focusing on is what we call epigenetics. That's the way that genes are switched on and off by particular marks on genes. And so they complement each other. And so what we're working together is how can we focus on the genetic alterations and how can we focus on those epigenetic changes to really develop a full spectrum of ways of treating and understanding patients. So it's a great collaboration.
That's wonderful. Thank you, Dr. Gilbertson. So turning now to Project 5, Patient Outcomes, I'm joined by Dr. Terry Armstrong. Dr. Armstrong, You and your colleagues have been gathering information on the outcomes of patients with ependymoma. Can you describe the goals of this research effort?
Absolutely. When CERN first began, there was really limited information on what people experienced who were diagnosed with ependymoma, partially because of the relative rarity of the diagnosis, and also because each individual clinician may not see that many people throughout the year. So when we started the project, it was really to learn what that experience was, to talk to people who are living with ependymoma to find out what it was like when they were first diagnosed. What symptoms did they have? What was their experience like going through the diagnostic process? And what was their treatment like? And then finally, we've learned a lot about what it's like to live with a diagnosis of ependymoma after you're done with treatment.
And now I'd like to ask you a handful of more specific questions. What would you recommend for treating neuropathy and related pain?
This is a significant issue for patients with ependymoma, particularly for those with ependymoma in the spine. And it's hard to give one blanket recommendation for treatment. Oftentimes, there's a trial process with the treatment, and then evaluation, and then trying another treatment. I think the most important thing is to not suffer with pain and feel like there's not a solution. It would be important to consider a second opinion if you're having a difficult time treating your pain. A second opinion with a pain specialist would be important because they may be aware of some additional therapies that your general physician may not be aware of. There is some good resources out there regarding management of pain. We do have information on our website that I would recommend people look at that includes some credible resources on the internet that can provide some additional information.
How effective are nutritional supplements, and do you have any suggestions of alternative medicines that could perhaps help?
That's a really common question and an issue that people face because you want to do things to make yourself feel better. Unfortunately, there's really limited research in this area. What we recommend to people that we see is that anything that you take, you should discuss with your physician. There can be interactions between nutritional supplements and alternative therapies and your standard treatment, and you want to try to avoid that. Additionally, if you start something, you want to be smart about how you do that. And what I mean by that is you want to try one thing at a time so you know what your response is and what any problems you may have with that treatment so you can evaluate it for yourself. Bottom line, you're in charge. It's your body. If there are things that you want to try, just be sure to talk to your treating physician about it.
Finally, Dr. Armstrong, you served as the editor-in-chief of CERN's new guidebook for patients, caregivers, and advocates. Can you briefly describe the contents of this resource and advise our listeners on how they might obtain a copy?
Absolutely. We're really excited about this resource because there was limited information available for patients and their families who are dealing with ependymoma. It's really an all-inclusive guide that talks about the diagnosis, the pathology, the treatment approaches, and even the symptoms that you may experience, as well as treatment for those symptoms. Additionally, it gives you information about how you can be an advocate for patients with ependymoma. There are several ways that you can get the guide. You can visit our website, and there are links there that will allow you to request it. You can also email directly. The email address is administrator@cern-foundation.org.
Thank you, Dr. Armstrong.
Thank you, Chaz.
Thank you for joining this podcast entitled Ask CERN a Question. For more information on the CERN Foundation, please visit our website at www.cern-foundation.org.